Hi, welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast brought to you by Shoshin Works in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I'm your host, Ed Powell, CEO at TensorX, where we leverage the cloud, the crowd, and AI to inform corporate strategy, drive system design, and optimize operational performance. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for resilient futures. In this series, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and the impacts they will have on the future. In this episode, we continue our dive into artificial intelligence, including how to leverage technology advancements to make initiatives more successful and how to design intelligent systems for the future. My co-host today is James Villarrubia. Hello, James.
Hey, Ed. Good morning. So as Ed mentioned, my name is James Villarrubia. I'm a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I help the engineers and the scientists there integrate AI into their sort of everyday work and research. So it's been quite a year for AI. So we've been sort of making a lot of interesting changes. So I'm really excited to sort of pick back up this thread with our guest today, Brian. So welcome, Brian Evergreen. We are so grateful for your time and sharing your perspectives in this third part of our series. Your insight and your work with artificial intelligence, I think, has been really informative for us and for our audience. And excited to sort of hear more about sort of the inside of that book that you're about to release. We are excited about autonomous transformation and really about some of the context of the sort of digital transformation that we've been hearing about, maybe sort of overused word. So Brian, why don't you introduce yourself again for our new listeners and sort of tell us a little bit more.
Wonderful. Thank you, James. And thank you, Ed, for having me. So Brian Evergreen, I always describe my career as having, I've had two or three careers already. The first was an internationally competitive chess player. I represented the US versus other countries. And then from there, I actually studied music theory and composition. I don't think I mentioned that in the first two episodes, but it's kind of a fun pit stop I made in my journey. And it's funny how it actually, now looking back, I see a lot of ways that it's contributed to the work that I do. We can get into that later if we want. But and then I've spent the majority of my adult career as a working in the corporate sphere, first with Accenture. I made a pit stop over at AWS. I've held a couple leadership roles over at Microsoft, those being the AI strategy lead for Microsoft US first. And then after that, the global head of autonomous AI co-innovation within Microsoft Research. And so, but all along the way, in terms of the even starting back with the roles I held at Accenture, I've been working to figure out this question of humans and machines and how do we capture and harness the economic and societal potential of these technologies. And I've been very fortunate in the clients and customers, partners that I've, colleagues that I've been able to work with at these various companies, and to really have a rich environment to sort of see, have a lot of purview and a lot of into what's working, what's not working, that all sort of led to me writing and researching and then even working with even more people in the interview process for my book. So I'm excited to share some more insights from what I've learned and glad to be here with you.
So thanks, Brian. Discussing kind of what is working and what is not working, earlier you talked about this idea of pilot purgatory and avoiding it by leveraging case studies. Can you share with our audience just some case studies and ways you've seen artificial intelligence integrated into organizational strategy and design?
Yes. So what I would say is that there's two pretty successful ways I've seen organizations harness some of the potential of AI. One, and to the name of the series here, a lot of it has to do with how they think about their ecosystem. And so one way is finding and hiring the right talent internally that can build, and deeply understanding the difference between what they want to build themselves versus what they may want to leverage that someone else either built that they're either going to acquire or that they're going to an off-the-shelf model that they're going to start with, whether that be from open source or from one of the cloud providers. But really a big part of the differentiator that I've seen for those that have been successful with those initiatives has been fully understanding the entire vision and picture of the ecosystem that it takes in order to have a successful AI initiative or even some degree of transformation. And then not just designing for the technology or for the solution, but designing for the entire social system of saying, okay, how do we make sure this is accounts for the fact that there's all the human elements in this? How do we make the partner feel that's coming in and they're going to be airlifting in some of their data scientists that are going to co-develop this with some of our data scientists? And how do we make sure that our domain experts are at the very beginning of the design stage and not somebody that's just, how do we not practice something I read about called data science Taylorism, right? Where the data scientist is coming in and all I need is the data and they're not interested in the domain experts. You have this friction. They end up developing something that has little to no applicability, or maybe it does have applicability, but now the moment there's an issue, the domain experts are all too happy to see it fail. So instead, designing all the human components around that are going to make this successful and build it and put it into production and maintain it, that's a big difference I've seen.
So when you're thinking about this human component within the system, how important is explainability in AI for the human to be able to understand why the machine is telling him or her what it's telling them?
So explainability, I would say, it's an important topic. And I think that when it comes to doing right by people, that when there's that risk, depending on what the system's doing, right? Like if you have a system that has learned the pattern of let's say it's an extruder and it's learned, you know, that when the viscosity is at this point, you need to add more of substance X, you don't necessarily need to deeply understand it. There's a lot less risk in terms of explainability for that system as long as it's performing correctly. When you have a system that's interacting with humans and that's generating text and has the possibility, like with generative AI, and has possibility to generate something that could be considered offensive or hurtful or best negligent, then that it's much more important. So that's the first thing, is that I think explainability, the degree to which it's important varies by the application and the potential for harm. And then I'd say that the way that I've seen some leading organizations think about it is because it's because of the fact that by the nature of the way that machine learning works is it recognizes patterns that humans haven't explicitly designed the way they would in statistics. Then by the very nature of AI, it is a black box that you're creating when you're developing using machine learning methodologies. And so what I'd say is that the explainability that I've seen that organizations focus on is being able to focus on what, based on this input, this is a consistent output we're seeing. And then when we maybe see something that we don't want, an output that we don't want, okay, we need to go back to, is it something about the input? Because the model itself is recognizing patterns between inputs. And so usually it starts with the input, right? So if you have an application where it's performing in a way that is harmful, it's performing based off of the pattern. It's not that the AI engineer in there is designing harm intentionally. I mean, theoretically, that's possible. But majority of cases that I've heard about or seen have been that, oh, there's some whole bit of, we threw a lot of data in there and there's some large swath of that does represent historic decisions humans have made that had bias or had some element that we don't want. And so now we need to go back and unfortunately redo this work that we've invested in to account for that, make sure that we're not having that representative sample in the input data. So I don't know if that was a full answer to your question, but those are some of the considerations I've seen leaders. And the other thing, one other I'll add for, especially for generative AI, because generative AI does not have its own authority. So if you ask it a question, it'll tell you based off of the corpus of data that it has, what it seems like the answer is using probabilistic math. But it can't tell you if that's the right answer. If you ask it, is that the right answer? It'll say yes, because that's how the program works. But it actually doesn't have its own authority. It's like the Chinese room experiment. If you're familiar with the Chinese room experiment, that if I go in a room and you pass Chinese characters under the door to me, and I look up at the wall and I have a lookup table and I give you the pass back other characters based off of the lookup table, your experience is you're having a conversation in leveraging Chinese characters, maybe Mandarin, with me, and maybe I'm really eloquent, right? And you think, wow, this is a really meaningful, it could change your life. You could think, I'm so grateful that person said that to me. Meanwhile, I don't speak Chinese, right? And so it's the same with the machines, where the machines they can translate in seconds from one language to another, but they don't understand either language. And so in terms of explainability, if you have generative AI and you're putting it in the front lines, so a frontline worker or a customer care agent or an astronaut, whoever it is that's leveraging, seeing output from a generative AI model, what I always recommend is pairing that with a visual window that you're also lifting the underlying data or the underlying document and highlighting the source and giving them that maybe the potential to click through and see, okay, there's five sources that this was generated from. You can click through and see the highlighted text that we pulled that from. And I think that's an example where maybe you don't have explainability on the model, but you're having explainability of like where the source of the information is so that you as a human can assign your authority to it and say, okay, that's correct. And therefore I'm going to make that decision.
So maybe you don't have explainability, but you have traceability. And
yes.
Traceability gives you confidence. Again, what you see for explainability is really building confidence in the user that the machine is giving him or her a correct answer.
That's right. Yep. So I want to sort of take this in a slightly different direction, because I mean, I think we've been talking about sort of explainability and traceability from a perspective of I have data, I know what I want to solve, I want to sort of analyze the applicability of that solution. So there's sort of an inherent evaluative framework with that, because I understand the problem I'm trying to solve, and I just want to judge whether I can trust my black box. But I mean, I think you mentioned something sort of different. We sort of talked about sort of future solving, and it seems to strike as like, well, I can imagine the farther you get out to the future that suddenly traceability is not an option at all, because I mean, there may not be data to exist to sort of imagine the future. Can we sort of, maybe a misunderstanding, can you explain the difference between sort of how you sort of describe problem solving and maybe the context of AI sort of this future solving, and explain it for our audience and for me, be great.
I'm so glad you asked that, James. Thank you. I'm going to thank you for asking that, because it's one of my favorite things to talk about. So problem solving is the craft of getting rid of what you don't want. But getting rid of what you don't want has no direct line to getting what it is that you do want. So an example of that is that let's say I don't want to be watching a TV show that I'm watching. And when I was growing up, you changed channels, right? You couldn't just click out and go choose another show. But let's say you're on a TV and you're on cable and you don't want to watch this anymore and you just change the channel. There's actually a higher likelihood that you'll get another channel you don't want than that you would to get the channel that you do want, right? And see a show that you want. And so the same is true in organizational context. So if you look at, and it comes from an inherently mechanistic mindset that we've inherited from the Industrial Revolution, which is that organizations are like large machines. And if you think about that mindset, what do you do when a machine goes down? You look for what the deficiencies, what the problems are, you solve the problem, machines go back online. When you want to improve the machine, look for more deficiencies, eliminate those. Now it's even more performant. If your code is not running quickly, look for ways you can condense it and make it more elegant. And now the code performs better. And so problem solving is a very important skill set when it comes to making machines better. When it comes to working with humans, problem solving inherently puts us into the condition of what I call maintenance mode, where we will continue to incrementally improve whatever the core value proposition that already was created, but you're not going to break through into anything new or have any kind of innovation if you're focused on only problem solving. And so instead, what I've codified is future solving. And so instead of solving for a problem, which also inherently is negative, so that's a whole nother reason, but more importantly, instead of solving on the future, solving for the future. So picking a future that you want. So let's say you said it's NASA, right? So let's say you said, okay, the future that we want is we want to colonize the moon, and we want to, and in order for that to, what would have to be true? Let's say that you started with that statement, right? That's a pretty lofty and pretty encompassing statement. But let's say you started with that statement. Okay, great. What would have to be true for us to do that? Ooh, okay. Well, there's a lineup of maybe 10, maybe thousands of things, right? That you would need to be true in order for us to actually successfully colonize the moon. And then, okay, great. Then each one of those, that first layer of breakdown from that future is the theories that you would have that you need to prove or disprove. Then each theory breaks down into maybe dozens or hundreds of hypotheses that need to be proven or disproven. Because if we're commissioning an expedition to the unknown, like we've mentioned in an earlier episode, we're advancing toward the future. That's not something that we can empirically prove. And so instead, we're leveraging the scientific process of saying we have a theory, and then that breaks down into hypotheses. So the next initiative and the next thing we're going to fund is this hypothesis that proves or disproves whether or not that's possible. And if not, we got to move on to the next one that ultimately accrue to those theories. And One of the things I love about this is that when you, if you imagine joining an organization today, most organizations, okay, these are the three initiatives that we've funded. This is what we're focused on. This is the timeline, ROI, the level of investment, and this is the set of tasks or the work stream that, you're responsible for. Welcome. And so that's fine, right? That's, we're used, we're conditioned to be used to that. Now imagine instead if it was, okay, you know, welcome to organization. This is the future that we're trying, that we're trying to create. This is the future we're solving for. And these are the things we believe would have to be true for us to get in the future. It already activates a different part of your brain, just even that far into the conversation. Then looking down and seeing, and these are all the hypotheses that we're currently testing. This is the one that we need your help with. And so, and then in terms of the work, maybe that hypothesis that you're working on is not the most interesting work you've ever done, but you have what it's accruing to and you have line of sight on it. Okay, hey, once we're done proving or disproving this one, I think a next sort of natural over in this area is something that I could focus on, and you can be envisioning the future of your own career track within this broader envisioned future from your leadership. And so I think that's, or I'm really hopeful in terms of what I've written in the book, that's one of the main takeaways for organizations is to redo the way that they do strategy to solve for the future. And instead of doing bottoms-up planning of trying to solve as many problems as they can and become incrementally more efficient at whatever value props someone else created, or maybe they created decades ago that now they're just maintaining. Instead, picking a future, and a good example that I also share that I didn't come up with, but that I uncovered in my research was Bell Labs. In 1951, their vice president called together his departmental heads that reported to him. And he said, he told them the telephone system, the US telephone system had gone down that overnight and it was irreparably destroyed. And they kind of whispered amongst themselves because somebody calls that morning. And he said, I'm telling you, anyone that doesn't believe me, it did go down. Anyone doesn't believe me by noon today, you're going to be fired. So obviously he had their attention. And then he said, let's pause on that part of the conversation for a second. And I want you to tell me, we were just named the best industrial lab. What are the top three things that we've done? Like the most innovative things that we've ever done. And the things they came up with were the coaxial cable, the transatlantic cable, and the dial, right? And so, and he asked, when have they been implemented? And this is 1951. And so one of them had been implemented in the, I think, 30s, and another one in the 40s, and then another one in the late 1800s. And so, and he said, great, when were they invented? When did someone create these things? It turns out they assumed, oh, well, this one was implemented in the 30s. It was probably invented in the 20s. Turns out all of them were invented in the 1800s. And he said, well, what in the world have you all been doing, right? These are all people, these were all invented before they were even born in many cases. And he said, it's not your fault. This is a systemic condition of our organization. You've been hired to maintain a system that someone else created, and you're doing a great job at that. But if we want to invent something new, we have to imagine, back to the way he started the conversation, we have to imagine that the system went down irreparably. Because if you want to start with the question of how do we improve the current system that we have, one, there's very few people who can answer that question. And two, you have an insane amount of constraints. If instead you imagine the thing went down completely and you're now going to build a new telephone system in the 50s based on all the advances in technology that have been made, I mean, that's how they came. They, through that process, they came out with tons of things that have now laid the groundwork for cellular technologies. Yeah, that's how they came up with the touchtone phone and so many other different advances that took place. Stemming from that conversation. So for leaders to pivot from, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to ask my team to tell me all the problems they want me to fund them solving this year, right? Which is abdicating vision in a way, right? I don't need a vision for my organization. I'm going to fund problem solving within my organization. Not to be harsh about it, but that's ultimately what that is. Instead saying, okay, this is the future that we're going to create and what would have to be true for us to get into that future.
I really like that example from Bell. I mean, sort of tying all the pieces that you sort of mentioned in this podcast series, sort of recognizing back to the sort of staircase example I used in a prior episode, which everyone should listen to if you haven't yet. but this idea of like, if you don't even have the vision of a second story, you'll never even start on the stairs, and the stairs will seem like nonsense, much less like having to justify each one via ROI. And we'll never get to the moon if we think about just like incremental improvements to rockets. That part of, I think, the benefits to NASA and sort of that was the sort of the cultural buy-in that JFK and President Kennedy provided with his famous speech. It's like, we must go to the moon, not because it's easy, because it's hard. It's that vision statement laid out the groundwork to say, okay, well, what if, how would we, what could we skip? What could we ignore because it's right. not a big enough leap. It's not going to get us there fast enough.
What would have to be true, right?
Would have to be true. Yeah. And I think it's a really great reframing of sort of future solving. So, and I'm gonna steal that Bell as example. I'm sure I'll reference it later. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. And I'm going to warn you right now that as you go through the rest of your day and week and months ahead, if you start to notice and start listening for how much people talk about, well, we have to start with what problems we're going to solve. It's like the episodes of TV where the glass breaks and now you can't unsee something, right? It's like that. We're now and I feel sometimes I'm on panels, right? And I heard someone else will say, yeah, but it really starts with what problem, before I mentioned future solving, right? We're talking about something else. And they'll say, yeah, but so the most important takeaway for leaders is you need to start with what problem you're going to solve and blah, blah, blah. And or startups will say, well, we solved this problem in the market. And so I'm just going to warn you now that you won't be able to unsee it. And it might start to drive you a little crazy how much everybody's focused on solving problems.
So what I hear and what I think about as you're talking is kind of the matchup of a couple of things. One is the very low success rate of these AI projects. And the amount of budget that is controlled by people whose sole purpose in life is solving problems. So, yes. Right. So if you look at the organization, all the budget's controlled by the ops people who are in the performance zone, right? Productivity zone. They are there to hit the number. They missed the wave. They missed the transformation zone. They're not in the innovation zone. Innovation zone is off in the future. The productivity zone, the production zone, they're all like about today, this quarter, et cetera. And I just am thinking about your experience at Microsoft, where in order to do this transformation, which is the really hard work, you say we're moving to the cloud, you put the cloud guy in charge of the whole company. And,
right.
And I just wonder how you see this with AI about the potential future for those who have the vision to end up basically with the keys to the company.
So how I think about the way that organizations can give them the keys to the company,
if they're going to be successful in hitting this wave,
right?
Because most of the organization is going to be essentially pushing against it. I mean, even when James and I were out raising money for companies, they would tell you, we sell painkillers. This is before opioids. We sell painkillers, not vitamins, right? But what you're really arguing is that there's a bit of vitamin here. We're saying, what could the future be as opposed to fix the pain?
Yes. I definitely think, I mean, if you think about, like, for example, and I know this could be a potentially controversial example, especially for NASA, I don't know. So I'm stepping on toes. Please let me know.
Let's go on controversy. Let's do it.
So Elon Musk, when he decided to make rockets that could land again and be reusable, right? He wasn't starting with an existing rocket per se and saying, how do we make that rocket better? He said, okay, if we actually want to be in a place where we're doing space travel ongoing, then we need rockets that can land again and be reusable. And so that's a future that he started with that he wanted to solve for. And so, and ultimately he did, right? And so that's what I would say is, and the interesting thing about that is that when you think about, to your point, Ed, about who's in charge, the thing that made that successful was he wasn't an aeronautical expert at the time that he set out with SpaceX, right? He had a vision. And so at the point of vision, it's not about necessarily the expertise. If anything, sometimes your expertise can bog you down because you're starting with all the constraints in mind instead of saying, okay, forget all the constraints. What future do we want to be in? Do we want to colonize the moon? Okay, well then what would have to be true? Do we want to be in a future where, let's say there's no child labor in our supply chain? Like, we can absolutely guarantee that. Like, what would have to be true for that to be the future that we've arrived at, and designing for the inevitability of creating that future? And so I think when it comes to leadership, back to your question, Ed, and the way that Microsoft went, yes, when they put Satya in charge, he started with that same question. He said, and this is something I had the great fortune of interviewing someone who worked closely with him and referenced in the book. But at the time that he took office, he said, we need a new business strategy. We need a new technology strategy, and we need a new people strategy. And he set out with a vision for the future of the organization. And so a leader right now, it's not necessarily that it even needs to have that needs to be a leadership shift with a new leader. It could very well just be that the leader that's in charge of whatever department or whatever group that it might be, or team even, it could be at the team level, they need to start with a vision for what future do they want to create and then work backwards instead of starting with what problem am I going to solve? Because at that point, you're just maintaining something someone either you created in the while in the past or that someone else created.
Yeah. And mashing up your Bell Labs story with Elon Musk. So I have a friend who was a retired general. When I met him, he was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And he was the first person that I know of who put reusable single stage to orbit was the key to the basically for the future of space. He then became in retirement the director of Ames, NASA Ames. But you, in Elon's book, you'll see he has like four pages devoted to him. And he, again, he came up with this like 40 years ago. So again, it's being reused, but you have to find the people with the right amount of capital and vision to go make it happen.
That's what I take away from this of the Elon story is like, well, you need vision, you need to be empowered, and you also need budget. Several billion doesn't hurt. But yeah, I mean, I think if organizations can actually, and back to sort of our example about the stovepipes, if you're going to bring in someone to run AI, it cannot be research, they cannot be off on their own. They need budget and they need authority to actually influence and change all sectors of the company, and not just the sort of things under their particular wing. Changing to HR strategy, changing your software strategy to enable AI. And I'm not sure everyone's grasping that. So I'm glad we're saying it here. We're saying it clearly. Bill, that's this up, guys. Brian Evergreen is telling you how to do this.
I appreciate it. And I'd say to you that, yeah, that's what I love about that example you gave of Ed is that it sounds like NASA already had the idea, which makes sense to me, well before Elon ever funded it. And I would ask, like, did NASA have the budget that they could have done it first? I'm going to guess that they did, right? But what the question I would ask is, what was it about the systemic condition of the organization of NASA that innovation didn't come from NASA? And that would be the question that I would ask and say, okay, if we want the next thing, the next big breakthrough or set of breakthroughs, because I know there's a lot of breakthroughs NASA is working on any given moment, if we want them to be successful, what would have to be true about, it doesn't just have to be what would have to be true to create that future. What would have to be true for these innovative initiatives to be successful within our organization? And that's maybe how I will close out, because I know we're over time, but I think that's the starting question is, okay, why is it that Xerox, there's 20 publicly traded companies that where the idea was conceived within Xerox, but then the people ended up choosing to leave. Why weren't they with pictures and photography? The first digital camera was conceived of inside of Kodak, right? Before they went down. And it was like 12 years or so. I don't remember the exact date, but it was over a decade later that finally a startup had started by the person who had initially, someone who was an ex-Kodak employee, and that ultimately introduced a digital film into the world. And so I think that happens time and time again. And that's something that I think that we need to solve for as leaders. This is, how do we make our organizations, can we change about the systemic conditions of our organizations that innovation thrives as opposed to ends up needing to leave because we're too busy maintaining the value prop we've already created.
That's great. So Brian, thank you again for walking through this fascinating topic with us. As this is a framework we should all be embracing, we consider ways to leverage the latest developments in artificial intelligence. If you have joined us for this episode, make sure to catch up the two previous episodes with Brian Evergreen on artificial intelligence and organizational design. Join us for our next Ecosystem Futures podcast series brought to you by Shoshinworks in collaboration with the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, in which we will continue to explore topics with leading experts on designing distributed networks for ecosystemic wellness. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can learn more at shoshinworks.com.